this didn't ever feel like a place. I mean, it was communist country. This is not anywhere I ever planned to go, right? I never thought, really, I'd like to go visit this communist country. No, that was a picture in a geography book, and I knew in my head that it really existed, but it might as well have been Mars or something for me to ever have any consideration that I would actually ever see that. It almost felt make-believe. And sometimes when we're talking about places that are so far away in the world, we can tend to think of them as not real. But the wonderful thing about this is that we're considering places where Jesus walked, where Jesus was born, where angels appeared to Joseph and to Mary and then to Joseph and gave them messages. And these are real places. These are real events. They happened on our earth, on another part of it, a long way from here, but they happened here. And again, it should cause us to contemplate the incarnation. Oftentimes when I see a brand new baby, a very small baby, sometimes I have the privilege to visit somebody in our church who's just had a baby, and you get to go see that day-old baby. Or sometimes they come to church for the first time a few weeks after the baby's born, and you get to see that baby. And one of the things that I often think about is, you know, God took on flesh like this. There was a point that the God-man was a little infant like this. And it's just amazing, really, to think about. And so we're going to consider many of these things in this Galilee region that we look at tonight. As we do this, I want to go through and do some reviewing. All right, we're going to consider, this is part four of our Hill Country, which is, the Hill Country is where a lot of the events of the New Testament take place. Let me move up, let's see here. So we have the Northern Hill Country, Lower Galilee, and Upper Galilee. As we've considered this Hill Country, we're going to get into the Galilee here, but I want to get to this map. And I want to go through our five longitudinal zones, and then I want to go through the areas of the Hill Country. So let me do this by way of review for you. This area here is called the coastal plain. We're getting better and more confident at coming up with the answers here. It might not be totally confident, but it was there. So we have the coastal plain, this area, the Hill Country, or the Central Mountain Range. And so we have the Hill Country, the Central Mountain Range through here. What do we call this area? Dead Sea, the Rift Valley. Very good. Over here on the other side of the Jordan River, these mountains. Other side of the Jordan is called the Transjordan, and they're mountains with the Transjordanian Mountains, the Transjordan Mountains. And then out here, this area that looks so dry, the Eastern Desert. So we have coastal plains, Central Mountain Range, Rift Valley, Transjordanian Mountains, and the Eastern Desert out here. All right, and then as we go through this area that we're considering right now, right here, this little area, sometimes you can find these little features in the geography. For example, this little thing that sticks out, that's Mount Carmel. Up in the north. Down here, this part of the Dead Sea is called the Lisan, which is Hebrew for the tongue. Today it goes all the way across, but in the ancient world it looked like that. So you have this Lisan, and almost straight across from it over here, there's this basin that we call the Negev. And then as we move up from the Negev, we get this hill country of Judah through here. Okay, and if we move just to the east of that, this dry area is still in the hills, but it's dry. That we call the wilderness of Judah. It's basically desert. Then as we move north of that, in this region south of the Jezreel Valley, this central hill country we call the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh, Ephraim and Manasseh's inheritance. Then up here, there's this valley that runs here across, and that's called the Jezreel Valley. And what we're going to consider tonight are these mountains that are on the north edge of the Jezreel Valley and make their way up. And we call that the Galilee. All right. So this is the final area of the hill country. So let's consider the boundaries of the Galilee. Galilee extends from the plain of Akko on the west. Okay. Plain of Akko on the west to the Sea of Galilee and the Hula Valley on the east. And I'm going to go one more slide because we get a little bit better. There used to be a little lake up here called Lake Hula, and that's now been drained and used for farmland. But that's called the Hula Valley, and then down here is the Sea of Galilee. So from the plain of Akko over here to the Sea of Galilee, that's the east-west dimensions of it. Okay, it stretches from the Jezreel and Herod Valleys, and I'm going to go back one, so we'll get a little better idea of it. From the Jezreel and the Herod Valley right here, stretches from there. That's the southern edge, southern border of it, if you would, to the mountains of Lebanon up further in the north. And if I go one more slide up here, Lebanon's up in this area. Tyre's probably up around there. Ancient Tyre, even modern day. up in that area. The Galilee is about 40 miles north to south and 25 miles east to west. The divisions of the Galilee. Galilee is divided into Lower and Upper Galilee, okay? So if we look at the Galilee, we're looking a lot at Lower Galilee here, so you can see the Jezreel Valley. Okay, the Jezreel Valley, and then the Herod Valley coming down this way. But this ridge here along the north edge of the Jezreel Valley is the beginnings of the Galilee, and this part is Lower Galilee. Okay, so we call that the Lower Galilee. And then we have the Upper Galilee up here. And it's called that because not because of north and south. In the ancient world, they didn't write their maps with north in the top because they didn't have compasses. They put east at the top of the map where the sun rises. But it's called Lower and Upper Galilee because of the elevation. The mountains of Lower Galilee do not exceed 2,000 feet in elevation. Well, the mountains of Upper Galilee exceed that greatly. Mount Meron in Upper Galilee is 3,963 feet above sea level, which is the highest point in Israel, except for Mount Hermon in the far north on the border of Lebanon up there. Lower and Upper Galilee are divided by the Beth Hakkerem Valley, which runs east from Akko to the northern tip of the Sea of Galilee. So it runs from here. You can kind of see this ridge here, okay, that goes right along here. There's this valley that actually kind of divides Lower Galilee here where the elevations aren't as high to the higher elevations in Upper Galilee. Most of what we know that happens in the Bible, a lot of what we know that happens in the Bible takes place here in Lower Galilee. A lot of the New Testament stories, at least. Okay, so let's consider some of the important cities in Galilee. Nazareth, which we've seen pictures of, is on this ridge right here at the north edge of the Jezreel Valley. We have this village of Nain here where Jesus raised the widow's son. Okay, then up here on the Sea of Galilee, we have Capernaum, Chorazin are up here, Bethsaida on this side. Sepphoris is over here. Okay, so we have some of these major New Testament cities that are in the Galilee region. Give you another idea, here's Upper Galilee a little bit. You can see a little bit of this ridge that makes up that Beth Hakkerem Valley that goes through here. Here's Old Testament Hazor. Which was conquered by Joshua. Here's in ancient times Lake Hula, which was up here. And there was actually kind of an extension of the Jordan River, if you would, that went north from the Sea of Galilee or flowed south into it and then flowed south out. And so we have these areas that are up in the north here. But then again, you can see the Lower Galilee along the Sea of Galilee and then the Upper Galilee up here. All right. So we're going to first consider probably the city that's best known to us in the Bible is Nazareth. Nazareth is located in the hills of the southern portion of Lower Galilee, overlooking the Jezreel Valley to the south. Nazareth was the home to Joseph and Mary. Luke 2, where I asked you to turn, we'll see it mentioned. Verse 39 says, "And when they had performed all things according to the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee to their own city, Nazareth." And so what we find is that they are from Nazareth. And as we see here, there was this, act of God to move them out of Nazareth to Bethlehem at the beginning of chapter 2, and all the world to be taxed. And Quirinius is the governor of Syria, verse 2, and all went to be taxed, everyone to his own city, that is to his hometown where his family was from. And Joseph went up out of Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, verse 4, into Judea, and to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And we know, for example, that in chapter 1, that an angel has appeared to Mary, verse 27 of chapter 1. 26, in the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God unto a city of Galilee named Nazareth, to a virgin espoused to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David, and the virgin's name was Mary. And the angel came in unto her and said, "Hail, thou art highly favored. The Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women. God has shown you grace. You will have the privilege of bearing the Messiah." And when she saw him, she was troubled at his saying, and cast in her mind what manner of salutation this should be. And the angel said unto her, "Fear not, Mary, for thou hast found favor with God. And behold, thou shalt conceive in thy womb and bring forth a son, and shalt call his name Jesus. He shall be great, and shall be called the Son of the Highest. And the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David. And he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever in his kingdom. And of his kingdom there shall be no end." Then said Mary unto the angel, How shall this be, seeing I know not a man? And the angel answered and said unto her, The Holy Ghost shall come upon thee, and the power of the Highest shall overshadow thee. Therefore also that holy thing which shall be born of thee shall be called the Son of God. And behold, thy cousin Elizabeth, she hath conceived a son in her old age, and this is the sixth month with her, who was called barren. For with God nothing shall be impossible. And Mary said, Behold, the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto me according to thy word. And the angel departed from her. And so we have this announcement from the angel that she's going to bear Jesus, the Messiah, the Christ. This is a picture of modern-day Nazareth, Catholic Church of the Annunciation in the front here. You can see the rolling hills of Galilee and Lower Galilee in this photo. All right, this is another picture taken from within Nazareth. And these are the tennis courts that Peter and James used to use. I'm kidding. Obviously, this is modern-day Nazareth. This is Mary's Well. It's what they call Mary's. Well, there's a place called Mary's Well that's a location, but this is actually the spring head where the spring came out in ancient times. Okay, so this is going back quite a bit of time. And I believe this is in the Greek Orthodox Church, the Orthodox Church. I don't know if it's Greek Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Church. That's there in Nazareth, and then you have the Roman Catholic Church there as well. But this is actually the springhead. The water runs through underground springs through the mountains, and this is where it basically came out and where in ancient times in the first century the women of Nazareth would have come to get their water. So this is basically, obviously there's bricks around it and things that may be different today. This is basically the same spring source that Mary would go to probably as a young woman to go and get the water that was necessary to have water for your household. This is inside the Catholic Church of the Annunciation. This is called Mary's House. Tradition says this is the home that Mary was in. Some of these things are very, very hard to know. I'll tell you how we locate some of these places. Okay, some of them it's just a tradition. Some church historian, maybe a couple hundred years after Jesus and after the New Testament, 200-300 years later, said this is where this was. Okay, and so we have, but again, if I were to say to you, 200 years ago, where did the Seminole Indians used to camp in this area or something like that? It would be hard for you to go show me, right? Now we could do some archaeology and maybe find some artifacts and might get some idea of that. But the idea that you would, be able to find where native peoples, the Timucua or somebody used to camp in this area, that would be very, very hard to find. No matter what tradition you have, we would question it, right? We'd need some other evidence. So another way that we do it is archaeological evidence. So we may find things at these places that point to them. Now, clearly there was a house here in the first century, and we know that. We have evidence of those things. But that it was actually Mary's home is hard to know. Okay. One of the things that we do find, though, is that sometimes there were, for example, the Romans, in order to dissuade Christians from going to those places, would build a pagan shrine there to try to scare Christians away because they'd put an idol at it. So Hadrian, for example, that was one of his favorite tactics. Hadrian lived in the second century. Hadrian is known in Roman history because he built a wall across the length of Great Britain, across the British Isle, the biggest of the British Isles. And because he was wanting to keep the what he considered barbarians out of the south, the Picts and others. And so he built a wall to just curtain off Roman Britannia from the rest of the island, which was a major engineering feat. He also oversaw the building of a building called the Pantheon in Rome. Pantheon was a Roman temple to all the gods. That's what Pantheon means, to all the gods. Today it functions as a Roman Catholic church, but he built that. Now, the amazing thing about the Pantheon is that the Pantheon is probably the most influential piece of architecture in the world. All right, it has this dome in it that most modern domes are copied after. So the dome across Rome, on the other side of Rome from the Pantheon, really not that far, it's really walking distance. You can go from the Pantheon and walk. I think it'd be about a mile, mile and a half at the most. I never measured it, but you could go to St. Peter's Basilica, which is where the Vatican is, and that dome is copied after the Pantheon dome. Okay? But not only that, if you go to Washington, D.C., the dome of the Capitol building in the United States is copied after the Pantheon dome. Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home, is copied after the design of the Pantheon, a dome with a pediment in front that triangular pediment in the pillars. The Jefferson Monument in Washington, D.C. copies Monticello. It's not just the United States. You can go over all over the world and you'll find that building copied. It's considered one of the architectural masterpieces of the ancient world. So as a Caesar, Hadrian was very powerful and is well known, okay? But he was very anti-Christian and he persecuted the Christians. And one of the things he would do is if there was a place, say in Nazareth or in Jerusalem or in Bethlehem, where Christians were showing up to see the location of these places, he would set up a temple to Jupiter or something like that. And so sometimes those kinds of things will give us a hint. Also, another thing that will give us a hint on these is ancient graffiti. So sometimes you can go into these buildings and you'll find graffiti that, you know, Christians coming to these places to try to see them would leave a message. They'd write something on the wall. Maybe they'd carve a fish, the ancient Ichthus symbol of Christianity, on the wall of it. And when we find those kinds of things, we know at least it was a Christian site, and then we'd have to start asking, why would Christians all come to this building here? And so tradition tells us this was the ancient home of Mary, where the angel, girlhood home of Mary, where the angel appeared to her and said, Hail Mary, right? You're blessed among women. And where she was given the message that she was going to bear Christ, the Messiah. Okay? And so that is Mary's house. Not only was Nazareth the home of Joseph and Mary, it was also the boyhood home of Jesus, right? After Jesus is born and they leave Bethlehem, they go back to Nazareth and they settle there. And this is where Jesus grew up, except for a few years in Egypt when they fled Herod's desire to kill Jesus. Jesus' early ministry was in the Galilee and at Nazareth. Luke 4:14. Let me invite you to turn there. Luke 4:14 says, And Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit into Galilee, and there went out fame of him throughout all the region round about. And he taught in the synagogues, being glorified of all. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up for to read. And there was delivered unto him the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. Because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, and hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovering of sight to the blind, and set at liberty them that are bruised, and to preach the acceptable day of the Lord, acceptable year of the Lord. And what we find here is this is a reference to Isaiah's servant songs. Isaiah 52 and 53 is the last of the servant songs, but there's four of them in Isaiah. This is one of them that he's reading, and he closed the book and gave it again unto the minister and sat down, and the eyes of all them were in the synagogue were fastened on him, and he began to say unto them, This day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears. He reads that scripture and he says, That's talking about me. That's a very bold thing to say. To read a prophecy about the Messiah, and he says, That's me. It's talking about me. All right? And I'll bear him witness, and wondered at the gracious words which he proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, Is this not Joseph's son? Okay? And so what we find here is this is the town. Obviously, many things have been built over and things, but this is the town where Jesus ministered. Because of many Gentiles around Nazareth, Galilee in general, after the Babylonian captivity. So after a little bit of ancient history with the Jews, what happened is God gave them their land under Joshua. We have the days of the judges. Then Saul becomes the king. God rejects Saul to being king, and David becomes the next king. His son Solomon becomes the next king. Solomon's son Rehoboam becomes the next king, but he's foolish and ends up losing more than half the kingdom. And it's divided between Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and Jeroboam in the north. And now you have two kingdoms, the southern kingdom of Judah, the northern kingdom of Israel. Various kings through those kingdoms. But eventually the Assyrians come in. And in 722 BC, the Assyrians destroy the northern kingdom of Israel and take them captive into their empire. During that time as well, they lay siege to many of the cities in the southern kingdom of Judah, but are unable to conquer it. The Lord delivers Judah out of their hand. But eventually, because of Judah's sin, God brings the Babylonians, the next world empire, to come and conquer them. And beginning in 605 BC, Jerusalem falls for the first time, falls again about 596 or so, 597, and then finally falls the third time for the final part of the Babylonian captivity in 586. And what we find is that they're dragged off to parts of the Babylonian Empire. Eventually, the Persian Empire conquers the Babylonian Empire. And under the Persian Empire, the Persians had a different tactic, and that was allow people to go back to their lands and support their religions and all these things. In other words, win favor. Make it as positive as possible to be a part of the Persian Empire. Don't rule with an iron fist. Rule in such a way that, an iron fist if they rebel, but if they'll submit, make life good for them. So you've got the stick and the carrot, right? You've got the carrot. We can make life really good for you, but if you rebel, we'll hit you with the stick. And the stick comes hard. And so that's how the Persians ruled. But they allowed the Israelites to come back to their land, and there's three returns to the land. Okay, the last of them is in 444 B.C. With Nehemiah, and he comes back to the land and rebuilds Jerusalem and the walls of Jerusalem. All right. But during that Babylonian captivity, during that time between 586 and their returns to the land, that 70 years or so that they're in captivity, 444, remember, is the last return of the three. In those returns to the land, what you find is that not everybody returns, and many of them are scattered throughout those ancient empires. But some of them do return. But when they return, many of those lands have now been inhabited by Gentiles. And so Galilee is sometimes called Galilee of the Gentiles. And because of this, there was a different accent spoken by them. The Jews of Judea and Jerusalem considered themselves superior to those of the Galilee because they probably spoke Hebrew and spoke it with what they considered a better accent. Okay? And, as people, even when we speak the same language, when we're separated by geography, it often can result in people having different accents. To the point that in big cities, sometimes different areas of those big cities sound different. You go to London and people have different accents in different parts of London. You go to New York and New Yorkers can tell you, look, I know that person's from Brooklyn. I can tell by their accent. Even though if you're not from New York, you might go, it sounds like a New York accent to me. But somebody from Brooklyn sounds different than somebody from the Bronx or somebody from Queens to their ear, and they can hear it. And so you can hear these various accents. And, we have different accents. You know, people talk differently in the bayou of Louisiana than they do in Charleston, South Carolina, than they do in, say, Appalachia in Tennessee, than they do in Boston, than they do in New York, than they do in the Great Lakes accent that I have that sounds like, Detroit and Chicago and Wisconsin, Ohio. That's a particular accent. You go to the middle U.S., the Midwest, Kansas and Missouri, they have that kind of considered what's the neutral accent that, most people try to copy when they have speech classes and things. And then, in the West, sometimes you'll get a little bit different accent as well. And so there's all these different accents, and that's just American English. And there's Australian English, and there's British English, and there's really not one British English. And then there's colonial English. And so we have all these different ones. And so what had happened is these different kinds of accents had developed among the people of Israel. And in the Galilee, they spoke differently. They had people around them who were impacting the way they talk. And, you pick up phrases and words and things from people around you and pick up their accents. And that's exactly what happened. And so this was an area that was called Galilee of the Gentiles and also was looked down upon. Matthew 26, for example, we see a reference here. This is after Jesus has been arrested. 26:73. Peter is warming himself by the fire while Jesus is on trial. And after a while came unto him that stood by and said to Peter, surely thou art also one of them, for thy speech betrayeth thee. In other words, you talk like a Galilean. We can tell where you're from. You're not from around here. That's obvious. You've got a different accent. Okay, and so there was this looking down on the Galileans. John 1:45. Says, Philip findeth Nathanael and saith unto him, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and the prophets did write, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. We found the Messiah. His name's Jesus. He's from Nazareth. He's the son of Joseph. And Nathanael said unto him, can there any good thing come out of Nazareth? Philip said unto him, come and see. In other words, are you telling me that out of that backwater hick country of Galilee, you're telling me the Messiah came out of there? And Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and saith of him, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no guile. And Nathanael said unto him, whence knowest thou me? And Jesus answered and said unto him, before that Philip called thee, when thou wast under the fig tree, I saw thee. Nathanael answered and saith unto him, Rabbi, thou art the Son of God, thou art the King of Israel. You must be the Messiah. Jesus answered and said unto him, because I said unto thee, I saw thee under the fig tree, believest thou? Thou shalt see greater things than these. And he saith unto him, verily, verily, I say unto you, hereafter ye shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. In other words, you're going to see more proof that I'm the Messiah. This is just a small one. And so, again, we can see the view that they had of the Galilee. In Isaiah 9:1, we can see this reference. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1 says, "Nevertheless, the dimness shall not be such as was in her vexation, when at first he lightly afflicted the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward did more grievously afflict her by the way of the sea beyond Jordan in Galilee of the nations," or Galilee, that word nations there means Gentiles, in Galilee of the Gentiles. And so this was an area that, and this is one of the interesting things, though, is even though this was somewhat of a of an area that was not cosmopolitan, the synagogues probably worshipped in Hebrew. And Judea probably certainly spoke Hebrew. But many of the Israelites, the Jews, when they had been taken captive, while they were in those kingdoms, Assyria, Babylon, the languages that was the lingua franca, the common language of the world that everybody did business in, that everybody, you know, it became the common language for people to speak. It wasn't their first language, but they wanted to learn it as a second language. The common language was a language called Aramaic. And we find that's the case, for example, when the Rabshakeh stands at the gates of Jerusalem when Hezekiah is king, and he makes this whole speech about how they should give up the city, and Isaiah and Hezekiah, and they go pray, and the Lord delivers them. But when that Rabshakeh, which is an office, it's not a name, he's an Assyrian official, when he stands there before the gate, he speaks to them in Aramaic, okay, because it's he speaks to them in Hebrew because he wants the people to hear the message. But they say, "Speak to us in Aramaic because we know that." He said, "No, everybody on that wall who's going to share, you know, your demise, I want them to hear me." And so we do know that Aramaic was the common language that was used as the lingua franca. Over the years, lingua francas have changed. Okay, Latin was, for example, at a time. If you were, say, living in the 1700s, early 1700s, and you wanted to study in a university, you had to know Latin. Lectures, especially in the 1600s, were all given in Latin. And one of the neat things about that is if you were German and you wanted to go lecture in England, you could go easily do that even though you didn't speak English because all the classes were in Latin. But imagine the challenge of this. You grew up speaking English and you've got to write all your term papers in Latin and give all your speeches in class in Latin. So they had to learn Latin. Okay, Latin was lingua franca. French became the lingua franca eventually, of business and things and diplomacy. But eventually what we see is today English primarily is. You know, if you ask somebody who doesn't speak English whether they'd like to learn English, most of them would love to have that chance. They want to do business in it, computer science. And most of the computer languages are based on English and these kinds of things. And so there's a lot of things in our modern world that are... I've been told, I don't know, I'm not an aviator, but I've been told every control tower in the world is supposed to have an English speaker in it. So that if you're flying, there's at least one language that somebody can communicate in. So English is kind of the lingua franca today. But here's what happened. Because they learned that lingua franca, while they were scattered all over these empires, they had Hebrew, which was their native language, their home language. They learned Aramaic, which is close to Hebrew. It'd be close like Spanish and Italian or something like that. Or Dutch and German or something like that. But because it was Galilee of the Gentiles, by the time the Greek Empire comes through and then the Roman Empire, a lot of people in the Galilee spoke Greek. What this probably means then, though, is that our Savior Christ probably was trilingual, that he would have learned Hebrew for the synagogue worship, would have read the Old Testament in Hebrew, would have known Aramaic because that's what many of the Jewish people spoke on a daily basis as their main language. Because it's what they learned in the captivity. And then because all of your neighbors who aren't Jewish, are Gentiles, speak Greek, that if you do business with those people, you have to know some Greek. And that was the common language of the world. So Jesus was probably trilingual. He probably spoke all three languages. And which is what makes it difficult, because the New Testament's written in Greek. And so when it says Jesus said something, we don't know whether he said it in Greek, whether he said it in Aramaic, or whether he said it in Hebrew, unless it's recorded for us. And even sometimes when it says he spoke the language of the Hebrews, does that mean he was speaking Hebrew or Aramaic, which the Hebrews also spoke? And the languages are very close, so because of that, it's not always easy to... So, for example, some of the sayings of Jesus in the book of Matthew, when he's on the cross, he says, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which is Hebrew for, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" The way that Matthew records it is definitely Hebrew. That's Hebrew, that's not Aramaic. Okay, but the way that's recorded in Luke, I believe it is, he says, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which doesn't look like Hebrew, but it's not clearly Aramaic either, which probably what it is here's Luke, who's a Greek. Remember, Matthew's a Hebrew. He's Jewish. Matthew transliterated it. Luke transliterates it. And when he transliterates it, he's doing it into Greek. So they're taking Hebrew and putting it into Greek, and the vowels change a little bit on it. But what we have, nonetheless, is this representation of Jesus quoting from the Old Testament, from Psalm 22, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But it appears that he said it in Hebrew. He was probably actually directly quoting the psalm. But there are other statements of his that may not be Hebrew. They might be Aramaic. And it's sometimes difficult to tell which is which. All right. So this is the Galilee that Jesus grew up in. All right. So that's the Galilee, the Nazareth. Nearby, and this is a little harder to find, we know Nazareth is here, but not too far from there. There was a little village called, here's, we have Cana on the map up here, but remember, these are short distances. Cana up here, but there's a couple locations that Cana could be in, and there's two modern locations, two places today that they think it might be. Cana cannot be located for certain today. It may likely be Kirbet Cana, about 8 miles northeast of Nazareth on the northern edge of the Beit Netofa Valley. Cana was the site of Jesus' first miracle of turning water into wine, where he showed forth his glory. Luke or John chapter 2, which we're very close to there. And on the third day, there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus saith unto him, they have no wine. And Jesus saith unto her, woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. His mother saith unto the servants, whatever he saith unto you, do it. And there was set there 6 water pots of stone, and after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing 2 or 3 firkins apiece. And Jesus saith unto them, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he saith unto them, draw out, and bear unto the governor of the feast. And they bear it. And when the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was, but the servants which drew the water knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom, and saith unto him, every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine. And when men have well drunk, than that which is worse, but thou hast kept the good wine until now. You're doing it backwards. Now, a note about what is good wine in the old world, okay? Today, in our culture, something is considered good wine because of the vineyard it comes from and how well it's aged. But it was a little like olive oil was treated today. So, for example, if you have olive oil today, you have different grades, right? And the best grade of olive oil is extra virgin. And then you have virgin olive oil, and you have these different grades of olive oil. And a lot of that has to do with when they're pressed. If you get the really good olives, the first pressing is the best often because it's the easiest to get out of the olives. That oil is really pure. And then as you get further in, you get more pulp from the olives and things in it. And so that other olive oil would be used for other uses. Even in the ancient world, they did this. You eat the extra virgin, but they used to put olive oil in their hair, for example. They'd anoint their head with oil, it talks about, because it would do 2 things. It would keep bugs out of your hair. Lice can't attach to oily hair, and it would moisturize your scalp and things. So it was a health thing. They would put a light layer of oil in their hair. Would give it a sheen and other things that would be considered desirable at that time. Not something we think of doing today, but that's what they did in the ancient world. And hey, it helped. It was considered a healthy thing. But you don't use the good olive oil that you're going to eat for that. You use the lower grade of olive oil for that because you're not ingesting it. Okay. Well, the same thing with the grapes. They'd put the grapes in the vat where they're going to crush them to make wine. And when they start to crush the grapes, the first wine that comes out, the juiciest grapes burst first. The most ripe grape juice comes out first. So the first collection is the sweetest wine and is from the best grapes. That is the better wine. Okay. Then when you're getting to the end and you've just got pulp and all kinds of stuff, you know, and you're pushing really hard because sometimes they'd put a big stone on a lever and they'd push it down on the grapes and you're just trying to squeeze the last drops out of that. It's less like grape juice and more like grape cider. You know, it's got all kinds of things in it. That's not as considered when that was wine made into wine, that was not considered as good of wine. So that's what it's talking about. We tend to read our own definition of good wine into it, but what they're talking about is this more scarce, harder to get first pressing of the wine is the better wine. The wine that comes later is the wine that the worst wine was the stuff that wasn't as sweet and that you had to really press really hard to get the last drops out of the grapes. And then you have in between, obviously, the different levels in between that. And so he turns this water into wine at this wedding feast, which is obviously miraculous. In fact, the way I've read the Greek text, my understanding is he actually turned the well into wine, not permanently. But as they draw the water, they're drawing wine out and putting it into the pitchers. Thus, the beginning of the miracles did Jesus at Cana of Galilee and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him. Cana was the site of Jesus' first miracle. Cana was where his second miracle, the healing of the Capernaum nobleman's son, was performed. John chapter 4, verse 46. John 4, 46. So Jesus came again into Cana of Galilee where he had made water wine, and there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. And when he had heard that Jesus was come out of Galilee, out of Judea into Galilee, he went unto him and besought him that he would come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Then Jesus said unto him, Except ye see signs and wonders, ye will not believe. The nobleman saith unto him, Sir, come down ere my child die. And Jesus said unto him, Go thy way, thy son liveth. And Jesus heals this man's son. That also took place in Cana of Galilee. Nathanael, also called Bartholomew, one of the disciples, was from Cana. John 21:2. They were together Simon Peter and Thomas called Didymus and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee and the two other of his disciples. Okay, so we find that there's this one of the disciples who's from Cana of Galilee. All right. So this is at another location. This is the modern village that is kind of Cana today. There is a church there. I think this is a Roman Catholic church that is the wedding church. Okay, so a lot of people want to get married there. Why? Jesus turned water to wine at a wedding feast, and so that's considered a especially good place to get married. That's in the village of Cana. But Kerbet Cana, which is more of a ruins, it may be the actual location. This is a little bit so near there, but not exactly. So in other words, the footprint of the ancient city doesn't match up with the modern city of Cana today. And if you go there, of course, as a tourist, they're going to try to get you souvenirs, Cana wine. I don't drink alcohol, and I encourage Christians not to. The Bible universally warns against drunkenness. But in our tour group, there was somebody who tried the wine, and they said it was terrible. But people buy it because it's Cana wine, after all. And so you'll see these kinds of things where they'll play off of this. The importance of Galilee in the ministry of Jesus. Jesus spent more time in Galilee than any other area. Okay? The beginning of Jesus' public ministry was in Cana. We just looked at that in John chapter 2. Jesus spent about 16 months of his ministry in Galilee. Considering that he ministered for 3.5 years, that's a considerable amount of time. 16 months. Jesus' post-resurrection ministry, when he gave the Great Commission, was in the Galilee. Matthew 28, verse 10. See, sometimes we don't think, where is Jesus when he's saying these things? But sometimes the text does tell us these things. Matthew chapter 28, Jesus resurrects, comes back from the grave, rises again. And as they went to tell his disciples, verse 9, behold, Jesus met them, saying, All hail. And they came and held him by the feet and worshipped him. Then said Jesus unto them, Be not afraid, go tell my brethren that they go into Galilee, and there shall they see me. And he goes into Galilee, and now, when they were going, behold, some of the watch came into the city and showed unto the chief priests all the things that were done, etc. But we find out, verse 16, then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee, into a mountain where Jesus had appointed them. So it's in Galilee where he gives this great commission to go into all the world and preach the gospel. All of Jesus' disciples except one came from Galilee. The Gospels describes Jesus' calling of his disciples in Matthew chapter 4, verses 12. We won't read the whole section, but just the beginning of it. Matthew 4:12. Now when Jesus had heard that John was cast into prison, he departed into Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt at Capernaum, which is upon the seacoast in the borders of Zebulun and Naphtali. So in the ancient allotments under Joshua, those Zebulun and Naphtali, those tribes inherited areas in the Galilee. That it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. Didn't we just read that in Isaiah chapter 9? Here's that prophecy being fulfilled, it says here. And the people which sat in darkness saw a great light, and to them which sat in the region of the shadow of death, light is sprung up. From that time Jesus began to preach and say, Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And Jesus, walking by the Sea of Galilee, saw two brethren, Simon called Peter, and Andrew his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishers. And he saith unto them, Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. And he begins calling his disciples. We find James and John, Peter and Andrew he calls, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee. He calls his disciples. All of his disciples, except for one, were from the Galilee. And that one is the betrayer. Judas was the only disciple not from Galilee. Many believe Iscariot is a reference to a town, meaning man of Kerioth, is a reference to the town of Kerioth in Judah. And that maybe Judas was not from Galilee like the rest of them, but almost all the rest of them were Galileans, except for Judas who betrays him. Most of Jesus' miracles were performed in the Galilee. Matthew chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11. As Jesus say here, 11:20. Then began he to upbraid the cities wherein most of his mighty works were done, because they repented not. Woe unto thee, Chorazin! Woe unto thee, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which had been done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. Now there's many negative things that the Old Testament prophets say about Tyre and Sidon, and let's not forget this is where Jezebel is from. Pretty wicked places. But he says, if I did my miracles in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon at the day of judgment than for you. And thou, Capernaum, which are exalted unto heaven, shalt be brought down to hell. For if the mighty works which had been done in thee had been done in Sodom, and it would have remained until this day, if I had gone back and preached in ancient Sodom, they would have repented, is what Jesus is saying. But he preached in Capernaum and did miracles, and they didn't believe. But I say unto you that it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for thee. And so we see he did a lot of his miracles, a lot of his ministry there in that Galilee region. And then Jesus' home was in the Galilee in Capernaum, Matthew chapter 9. I think we've read this verse maybe already. And he entered into a ship and passed over and came into his own city. And behold, they brought unto a man sick of the palsy, lying in a bed. And Jesus, seeing their faith, said unto the sick of the palsy, Son, be of good cheer, thy sins be forgiven. And so what we find here, and behold, certain of the scribes within themselves, this man blasphemes, etc. See here, verse 7, and he arose and departed his house. And the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God, who had given such power unto men. And so here he is in the Galilee, and Jesus passed forth from thence, and he saw a man named Matthew, that is Levi, sitting at the receipt of customs. And he says, follow me, and he arose and followed him. And he preaches, etc. So we find him here in this Galilee region, into his own city in Capernaum, here in the Galilee. All right. Now, I have some other slides here, and I have a lot more slides, but I'm done with my notes. So we've kind of summed things up, and we'll just go through these last slides. So we considered Cana, considered Nazareth. Now we're going to look at some slides that have to do with Capernaum and Chorazin. Okay, here's an aerial view of Capernaum right on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. All right, so you can see it from above. This is ancient Capernaum. I'm going to point something out. You see these dark stones. All right, these are basalt rock, which is ancient rock that comes from basically from lava. Okay. And this was the native stone to this region. This over here is the ruins of an ancient synagogue, which was built with limestone. Limestone actually came from Judea down in the Jerusalem area and was quarried there and brought all the way up there, so it was more expensive. And it was used for that purpose. If you go to Jerusalem, you'll see a lot of things made out of that native limestone. But here, so you can see the older buildings and some of the just common houses of Capernaum in Jesus' day, first century Capernaum, or first, second, third century Capernaum here. Here you have this synagogue. All right. Now let me go back a little bit. You see this right here? A church has been built over the top of what's called Peter's house at Capernaum. Now, what they used to do is build on top of it. Now, to try to respect the archaeology, they've built this one above it. Okay. This is called Peter's house. There's some good archaeological evidence that it possibly is. Again, we have a lot of graffiti inside this house that looks like this was a place of Christian worship. And this may very well be, this is a good place to show you the setup of an ancient house. This wall is not complete. There would have been a roof on this building. But then you have a courtyard around it where there are animals and they did their work outside. This area was primarily for sleeping. Okay, this small area was where your family slept, but you did a lot of your work during the day and stuff outside, and maybe your goats and sheep and things were in this area. So when it says coming out of your house, it didn't always mean this building. It meant that courtyard area that was around your house. All right? But if this was Peter's ancient house, this would be the place, for example, that Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law. Okay? And that this would have been a place where Jesus did a lot of preaching and teaching. So here we're looking at the actual, and if not, these are stones from the day of Jesus that as he walked through this village of Capernaum, he most certainly walked past these places, even if this isn't the exact place. So when you think about this, this is an amazing thinking. These 2,000-year-old stones that are part of a house that is very possibly the home of Peter on the season, on the shore. And think about it. Here he is, a fisherman. Pretty good place to live if you're a fisherman, right? The shores of the Sea of Galilee. And we're right here looking at the walls. Again, there's ichthus fish carved in and other graffiti carved into the walls of this building. And so it goes way back in ancient times as a tradition that this is the place that was Peter's home. Okay. Also, if you go to Capernaum, you'll see other things. Here's a Roman milestone. The Romans built very good roads. When they built those roads, they would put a marker every mile so you know how far you traveled. And it's a Roman, on the Via Maris, the Way of the Sea, that trunk highway that we talked about. Let me go back. Okay. Remember, there was this highway that came up the coastal plain, and then it cut through here into the Jezreel Valley. And then it would make its way up here and cut over. See this highway going across along the edge of the Sea of Galilee and then go up this way, that road, that dotted line, that would go up into Syria, okay, and make its way into the Fertile Crescent, and you'd take the rivers down to Assyria or Babylon or those kinds of places. And this, remember, this road, this came out of Egypt, so there was huge caravan trade that went through there. All right, so Capernaum's right along that route. And that route came through the Galilee up this way along the shores of the Sea of Galilee. And so the Romans had their mile markers along that route. Another piece of history, this is displayed there, but this is an ancient mosaic from around the time of Christ. That came not from this town, but from the town of Magadan, which is probably where Mary Magdalene might have been from. And you can see, here's a picture, a mosaic picture on mosaic tile, of a boat fishing on the Sea of Galilee, contemporary to the time. Okay, so again, you can see artwork from that ancient time. Here, olive press. They'd put the olives in here. There'd be wooden pieces that would have worked as an axle, and either a person or an animal would push this in circles around inside of there and press the olives into olive oil. So you could see. Now, when Jesus says, if somebody causes a young child to offend, to sin, it'd be better for him that a millstone be hanged around his neck and he be cast into the middle of the sea. All right, this is not a little stone. If we tied this around your neck and threw you in the bottom of the lake, you would not be able to swim with this around your neck. It's heavy. Okay, it's about 100 pounds, usually. That's what Jesus is saying. Everybody in that day, you can see multiple millstones here. They knew what a millstone was. They used them every day in their everyday work. To us, we're like a millstone. I can kind of picture that. When you actually see them, then you can kind of go, oh, I get it. I see what they are. Okay. Move on to the next town of Chorazin up here, a little bit further from the coast, but looking down on the Sea of Galilee. Here's the ruins of Chorazin, Chorazim, as it might be written sometimes. All right, and again, you can see the ruins. You can see this town has got a lot more of the basalt rock. It doesn't have the limestone as much. Again, ruins, residential area. These would have been maybe the home areas there in Chorazin. This is the synagogue, the ruins of the synagogue at Chorazin. You can see the pediment that was possibly on top of it. Again, the basalt rock it's made out of. This here is a Torah ark. It's the remainder of it. In the synagogue, they had to keep the scroll of the law of Moses somewhere, right? So they had a cabinet that they kept it in, if you would. And it would have been, this would have been a piece of that. And they would pull that out to read, just as we read Jesus did, right? He opened up the scriptures and read to them in the synagogue. This kind of thing took place. I mentioned this morning. This is Moses' seat. This is Hebrew written on the front of it. This is the ruins of it, but this is a piece that would have been called Moses' seat that the ruler of the synagogue sat in. So when Jesus said, obey the Pharisees because they sit in Moses' seat, that's where the ruler of the synagogue sat, in what was called Moses' seat. Okay, not literally a seat that Moses sat in, but it was metaphorical. The teacher, okay, a rabbi or somebody would sit there. This is in the ruins of that synagogue in Chorazin. This is a rock hyrax, okay? Now the reason I'm showing you this is they run all over that area. It's a rodent that lives in that area, and you're saying, why are you showing me pictures of a rodent? The Bible actually makes reference to them. They're called conies in the King James sometimes. Okay? And they were very common in this area. This is kind of a stock photo of one. I couldn't find one that wasn't protected like that give me permission to use it. But you can find pictures. If you were to Google them, rock hyrax in Galilee, you'll see they're all over the place. They're running all over the rocks. When I was there, I saw them, but they're kind of quick. When you point a camera at them, they think you're going to eat them or something, and they run away. But so I never got a good picture, not a non-blurry picture of one. But here's a picture of these rodents that run around in that area live in the rocks. And they were there. They were just everyday life in that part of the world. This is a Galilean mountain lion. No, it's just a house cat that was walking in the ruins of Chorazin. All right. And then again, we get an idea of this area. Right here, remember we were looking at this road. There's this path that comes down. Here's Magdala, Gennesaret, Capernaum. Here's Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee. As we come down this way, there's actually a pass here that's called the Arbel Pass. Okay, but before we look at that, we're going to look at Sepphoris. Sepphoris isn't mentioned in the Bible, but it was being expanded and built in the days of Jesus. And it was the Gentile city. And the reason I'm going to show it to you, here's an aerial view of Sepphoris. Okay, and we can see the ruins of it. But you can see the remnants of what is called the Roman city. You can see the amphitheater that all the Roman towns had. Okay, here's the citadel that was built during the Crusader times at Sepphoris. Here's the Cardo. Okay, so let me give you the Romans. It's funny because the city of Rome is a jumble of spaghetti streets that just intertwine with each other. Rome is not laid out. It just kind of kept expanding. But when the Romans built a town, they laid it out in a particular, they usually had two perpendicular streets. One of the main ones was called the Cardo. Okay, so this was the Cardo at Roman Sepphoris. And this is the road, and this is the sidewalk. So you can see the wealth that was in this town. The sidewalk, if you would, is made of mosaic. Imagine if the sidewalks up and down Winter Garden were mosaic tile. You know how much that would cost to do? How much human labor there is in that? I mean, artwork that people are walking on. And what would happen is that vendors would set up their booths along here, and these pillars would be there. They'd put canvas roofs over it so that they could be in the shade while they did their business along the sidewalk, if you would. And this was the main street that people walked on through ancient Sepphoris. But here, notice this street. You can see the wheel ruts right here? You see these lines? From wagons, chariots, whatever, going up and down this road so many, many years. But this is a 2,000-year-old road. You might look at it and go, it looks kind of bumpy. It is. But our roads are 10 years old and they look like that. So when you think about the fact that the Romans 2,000 years ago built a road that's still there. In fact, in many parts of Europe, the basis of some of their roads, the foundations, they don't dig up the Roman roads. They just pave over them to make them smoother. Because the foundation bases were built so well by the Romans. The Romans, one of the things we have to understand, they borrowed their religion from the Greeks. They borrowed their philosophy from the Greeks. They borrowed a lot of things from the Greek culture. But the thing Romans were really good at was engineering. And so their roads are really good. Somebody said, if you could take an ancient Roman and bring them to our time, they wouldn't be amazed by some things. But the things they'd want to see are interstates. They'd say, how'd you build that? You have that bridge going, this overpass going over this road and another one coming. The interchange over here where the 429 and the turnpike and Highway 50 all meet. The Romans would sit there and go, look at this. How did they do this? They'd be amazed. Us, we're like, yeah, that's everyday life. But that's what the Romans were engineers, especially civil engineers in building buildings. Roman Sepphoris was being built in Jesus' day. You can see a mosaic. Now, one of the things we know is that if this was a Jewish house, they were probably not practicing Jews. Some practicing Jews would have had mosaics, but usually would have had designs, not pictures. But right here in the middle of this is a picture of Hercules having a drinking contest. Okay? And he's having a drinking contest with the god of wine, Dionysius. Okay? And Hercules is going to lose, by the way. So as mighty as he is, you don't really want to have a drunken contest with the god of wine. And so here you have, these are all based on ancient Greek mythology and stuff. So there's all kinds of false gods and stuff represented. But you think about the artwork that's involved here. And this is an amazing place. Now, the reason I'm showing you all these pictures is not just because they're interesting, but that this town was being built in Jesus' day. And what was Jesus' father's, his adopted father? He didn't have a biological father. He was conceived miraculously in the womb of Mary. But his adopted father, Joseph, what was Joseph's trade? A builder, a carpenter. Sometimes it's translated carpenter. But the Greek word is tekton. Okay, tekton. Okay, in the ancient world, if somebody was a soldier in Greek, they were a stratian. But the general was the archistratian, the chief soldier. If somebody was a priest, they were hierus. If he was the high priest, he was the archihierus, the chief priest. Okay? If somebody was a builder, they were a tecton. If they were the master builder, they were the architecton. That's where we get the word architect. Okay? So the master builder was the one who was laying it all out and planning it. When it says that Jesus' father, Joseph, was a tecton, he certainly knew how to work with wood. But I know all the Renaissance pictures, you know, paintings have him planing some piece of wood in a workshop and making a table or something. That's not really what a tecton was. This was probably somebody who did stone cutting and worked with wood to build buildings. So if you consider this was the major city being built within walking distance of Nazareth, where was Joseph probably working? In Sepphoris. Okay? So we don't know this for sure, but the archaeology seems to lean this way. This, not necessarily this floor, but this city, probably maybe even Jesus helped as a boy, was being built by the hands of people like Joseph who worked as builders in that area. And so that's why Sepphoris has importance, because it was an area that was a growing, wealthy city where people were hiring things to be built at the time. All right. And then again, we mentioned this road, this main highway that goes through the Arbel Pass here. And I want to show you this. You can see right here, see this pass that comes down. Here's the Sea of Galilee. It goes off this way, this road. You see how that would be a natural place for a highway to come through right along the north shore of the Sea of Galilee? This is the Arbel Pass, okay? But out here in the distance, these two points, see, that make horns on this mountain? Those are called the Horns of Hattin, all right? The mountain here, horns, the Horns of Hattin. In 1187, this is where Saladin destroyed the Crusader army. The Crusaders were camped near here. It's a high point, so you have the high ground. And what Saladin did was he cut off the Arbel Pass, the Muslim general. He cut off the Arbel Pass so they couldn't get down to the water. And it was a dry season, and there had been a drought. So the grass, which is very green in this picture, was very dry. And he had his men set fire to all the grass around and basically choked them out, and they couldn't get any water to put out the fires. And ended up destroying the Crusader army at the Horns of Hattin. Okay? And so that's a major event in this part of the world, because it secured this area as Muslim-controlled from that point on, pretty much, until modern times, as a Muslim-controlled area. And so the Crusader army was destroyed there at the Horns of Hattin. Let me say this, too. There's a lot of revisionist history about Saladin, about what a great guy he was and all kinds of things, and how he was better than the Crusaders and stuff. Okay, it's medieval warfare. They were both brutal. Okay, Saladin was not this gracious, open-minded human rights observer. Yes, there were times that he let people go and showed clemency to them, but that was because he could get some money out of it or other things, okay? Let's just remember, this is medieval warfare, and it was brutal. All right, this was an era when people, you know, there wasn't a lot of quarter given to somebody in a battle, unless you could hold them for ransom and get some money for them, which he did sometimes for some of the rulers from Europe, because he knew they'd buy their king back, or they'd buy a lord back, or somebody like that. But that happened in this area. Okay. Now here's the Mount of Beatitudes. There's sort of this natural, you can see the Horns of Hattin and the Arbel Pass out in the distance. There's this natural amphitheater that is formed here. And this is the area we traditionally is considered the area where Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. Okay, but you could see how that would work. You're down here, and all these people are seated on this area that slopes down to the sea, and you have a natural amphitheater, and it's a good place to preach. You'd have good acoustics. It's out in the open. People would be able to gather there and sit down. And so, again, we can picture a place. When you pictured the Sermon on the Mount, I don't know how you pictured it. As a boy reading it, I'm thinking he's sitting in the synagogue preaching somewhere. But he was on a mountain, we know, on a hill, and that would very well, I mean, when we know he was in the Galilee when he preached it, and that would very well easily be this area. Again, remember, here's this sermon prepared and preserved for us in the Gospel of Matthew, at least the summary of it. It may not be word for word, but what we find is that we can go basically see the basic place very well where it took place. Imagine that. How many other things that happened 2,000 years ago can you go find where it happened? There's some. But, again, remember, we're talking about, here's the events in Jesus' life, the events in the Gospels, the truth about Jesus, and this is all, I mean, you can go there and stand where Jesus would have preached this sermon, or where people sat and listened to him, stood and listened to him. It really is amazing. Again, I often say this, if you get a chance to go, some of you have told me you've been, that's great. But if you haven't been, and sometime in your life you get a chance to go, as a Christian, it is really helpful. You get a better understanding of your Bible. It's not so much that you get a tingle in your, you know, down your spine or a quiver in your liver always, but just the idea that you're able to see this, and all of a sudden things just start to click. You start thinking about passages of Scripture, and if you have a good guide, he starts drawing out these passages of Scripture, and you go, oh, I see, that makes sense, okay? And so that's that road along the Sea of Galilee. And then here's the Sea of Galilee and Mount Hermon. This is a poor picture, I'm sorry, but you can see the snow-capped Mount Hermon that you can see from the town of Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee. It was a little foggy that day when I took that photo, and it was I think, beginning to be dusk when I took the photograph. But you can actually see Mount Hermon. If I go back, you can't see Mount Hermon on this map. It's up here. But here from Tiberias, you can see that northern mountain up in Israel. All right. So again, we have this wonderful privilege to consider the life of our Lord. That's especially what we're able to focus on tonight. In future weeks, we will be going through the Rift Valley, okay, Sea of Galilee. So we'll see a little more about Galilee, but we'll consider more the sea and the geographical region there, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea, some of which we've already seen some photos of, but we'll spend a little more time focusing on a couple things with that. And then we have the Transjordan Mountains. I don't know that I'll do one on the Eastern Desert, but I am going to cover a couple of weeks on Jerusalem, so you can see the layout of ancient Jerusalem, because that will help you in the life of Jesus some, and in the life of David as well. And then we'll probably talk about Paul's missionary journey. So we have several more weeks of this. Some of you have said you found it helpful. Others have said you like pictures. So in whatever way it helps your soul, it does help us the visual learning here sometimes. Let's pray. Father.